Good evening. This is Redwood Wonk. I'm with Dave Frank. My name is Eric Kirk. We are going to discuss the politics of the day, and actually we are going to talk the politics of the year. This is our last show of the year, and we are going to talk the three major political stories of the year. We're going to start with, I think, the first big story of the year on the day that there was supposed to be a peaceful transfer of power. Actually, they were supposed to count the Electoral College votes and formalize it, and it did actually happen, but a major disruption on January 6th of this year, and we will talk about that and the fallout of what happened. And then also the economy. It's had its ups and downs. Actually, it's kind of up and down at the same time. It sort of depends on what you focus on and the political impact of that and the pandemic. And is it going to have a positive, negative impact on the economy? And then lastly, we're going to talk about where we're at going into the midterms next year. Will the Democrats retain control of either or both branches of Congress, and what's going to happen? We're going to talk about that. But the first topic is the story that just keeps evolving and changing, and that is January 6th. We have a committee in Congress created by the bare Democratic majority with the assistance of two and only two one moderate Republican and one very conservative Republican who was a never Trumper, and Liz Cheney, but principled on this one item. And it has heated up. I don't even know where to start. Dave, why don't you talk a little bit about where we're at with the January 6th committee?
Yeah, sure. So I guess we'll work backwards chronologically. I mean, the most mm-hmm. recent information that I heard is that we're in a situation where they're still gathering evidence and testimony from individuals who they're trying to paint a picture that they can present in a report this summer, where it would spell out in very vivid detail the chronology, the timeline of what happened on that day for the record, and then they would then sort of rehash that in a political way, even though they're not intentionally doing it in a political way, but they would use it in the next the midterm elections come November. So that's sort of the end game. That's sort of building up to a head, I would say. But in the interim period, this gathering of the testimonies has been challenging, in part because it's difficult to collect documents from the various parts of the U.S. government. It's difficult to get people on the record, and also it's unclear if they're going to get cooperation from many of the principals involved. So that's sort of that's the broad brushstrokes, and we could kind of dive into any of those elements kind of as you see fit.
And there are about a dozen lawsuits about it. People suing to prevent them from being able to have to suing to in defense against the subpoenas. There is at least one referral to the Department of Justice. Actually, two referrals now for contempt charges. One that has been filed against Bannon, and one that may be filed against Meadows, still waiting for a decision on that, very likely to be filed. Merrick Garland does not rush. He takes his time and moves along, but it sounds like that's going to happen. And and we have Trump actually suing to prevent access to the archives, which is really interesting, citing presidential privilege. Which it still hasn't even really been determined as to whether or not a president who is not sitting in office can claim privilege. That has not been litigated yet. It's been raised and discussed, and it seems like the courts have made some decisions without having to make that decision yet. Somewhere along the line, that's probably going to have to be decided. Can presidential privilege apply even if the current president doesn't want to invoke it. Maybe there's an argument saying, you know, well, just because if you're a president, you want to basically act knowing that it's going to be protected in the future. There's an argument for that. On the other hand, does that last into perpetuity? Who knows? We will find that out undoubtedly. And if so, to what extent?
So what the element that you raised about executive privilege, we've all heard it over the years that, you know, you have this lawyer client, attorney client privilege, and that the presidential advisory privilege would be the most extreme version of that because you're running the country and there's national security concerns, et cetera. But this sitting president has not shown a willingness to protect very much. But that said, I just heard in the last, 48 hours or so, that the National Security Council documents that the committee has requested, the presidential team has expressed an unwillingness to share it. And so the committee rescinded their request and basically said, well, we're not going to ask for the things you don't want us to ask for. And in part, that's because it's a Democratic-run committee and a Democratic administration, just calling it like it is, balls and strikes. There's an agenda and there's a calculation. It's very political. That said, though, it's such a serious, I would call it, scar on our nation's history that there's an imperative to reveal the machinations that happened behind the scenes. And so there is a new revelation, I think. I was going to mention this to you earlier, but I like the fact that we're just bringing it up for the first time together. I'm not really sure if you've heard this before even, Eric. But I heard Peter Navarro actually released the plan itself, the actual blueprint of decision to have Congress not approve the Electoral College outcome. And so Peter Navarro, they're calling it the Vince Lombardi's Green Bay Sweep. So for folks who don't know what that is, because it's a long time ago that Vince Lombardi coached the Green Bay Packers and a Super Bowl victory. The idea is that you're just going to overwhelm the other side with your force. And they could see it coming. They could know it's coming. They could watch it happen, unfold slowly. It doesn't matter. Your force is sufficient that you gain the advantage and get your goal. You get what you want. And so they took this. Apparently, this was talked about for a long time. Part of the strategy, not just in this January 6th, process of stopping the actual election certification, but it was used before. So Newt Gingrich, I saw a Washington Post headline from 1995 article, but there was a headline too. So it's part of the Republican Party playbook. And Newt Gingrich referenced it back then when he was talking about how he took over as Speaker of the House of Representatives and they pushed through their agenda. There was actually a New Republic cover article that had a little mini Newt Gingrich and it said, run, Newt, run, because he mapped it all out. Once the election had happened, he said, this is what we're going to do every hour of every day for the first 100 days in office. And they changed a bunch of rules, like cutting staff, etc. That's a little bit off topic here, but the point is that they're going to use they projected what they were going to do ahead of time. So Steve Bannon actually said on the morning of January 6th on his show War Room, there's a video footage of it. He said, got to keep saying the mantra. You call the play, now run the play. It's like the old Green Bay power sweep. It's very simple. One thing leads to another. It's very logical, and victory is affirmed. So they had a strategy. So the question I would say is, was it an open conspiracy? And does the fact that it was open and telegraphed and openly talked about, does that shield any of the participants from criminality or not? And that's going to be a question that the committee is going to have to address and push to Merrick Garland.
I'm sort of wondering, did the breach of the Capitol, was that part of the plan or did it frustrate the plan? I'm wondering if they actually had a game plan about, obstructing, and if they were going to push Pence into, refusing, and then there would be court battles and things like that. If Pence could refuse enough of that it would lead to a court battle, it wouldn't happen on that day, and that the Constitution would be violated. But with everybody having to run and hide and be terrified, did Pence lose his nerve? Now, they say that he was discouraged from doing this, but after talking to former Vice President Dan Quayle, and you know, talking to a little bit about elders with the elders of the party, and maybe kind of breaking away from the Trump crowd, and you know, and said, yeah, maybe I don't want to be part of this, because they did call him a traitor. He is on the outs. He's trying to work his way back in, but he's on the outs with that. But what if that was supposed to be part of the plan, and then the Democrats go, you know, on in? But if they just keep pushing that, you know, the steal, stop the steal, stop the steal, and Trump, because the whole time he just never admitted that it was stolen. I mean, it was just a constant push. And I wonder if he could have gotten his way if this other thing didn't happen. Maybe it really wasn't part of the plan. Maybe that was what was, I don't know. I'm just speculating here. Maybe that ruined the plan. I don't know.
And to be fair, I mean, there's a couple lanes going on here, too. There's the people who organized the events at the Ellipse that day, who actually have said publicly on the news, you know, through public media, but also they've cooperated with the committee and they've said they want to know what happened. They didn't expect this. So the people that organized the actual rally itself, they said, I heard one of them say, you know, when Trump said, everybody, let's go to the Capitol, they thought we lost it. Like, we don't have a permit to walk to the Capitol. There's no security to walk to the Capitol. This what is happening here? And so that's one lane. But then there's the other lane of all those folks who now we know from those text releases and phone call releases that were constantly trying to call Mark Meadows and say, you got to stop him. You got to stop him, right? Meaning the president. You got to have them stop this. You got to have the president say something to stop this. So it was coming from their own team. So that's a second lane. Then there's this third lane of those people who I think are the ones that were ultimately going to see called to the mat, that sort of knew that there were these competing interests here, to this overwhelming force that they had lots of, you know, arrows in their quiver, so to speak. The bottom line is, I mean, I heard one of Obama's top campaign advisors, his name is Chai Kamanduri. He was on MSNBC on the Ari Melber show, and he quoted Goebbels, you know, the Nazi propagandist. He said, the bigger the lie, the more likely the people are to believe it. The idea is that you telegraph your lie, and when people see it coming, they're more likely to accept it. So there was whether it was open or blatant or planned or accidental, will to be determined. But the idea was that they were just going to full court press this thing and make it so.
Well, maybe Antifa really was involved. anyway, I'm going to be bringing this up again in our third segment, because Trump is going to be holding a press conference in Mar-a-Lago about this on January 6th, and I think Republicans are cringing about that.
The Court of Appeals here in Washington has ruled quickly in our favor. We are getting a clearer picture of what happened, who was involved and who paid for it, and where the money went.
Mr. Meadows received numerous text messages, which he has produced without any privilege claim, imploring that Mr. Trump take the specific action we all knew his duty required.
We do not take this vote lightly, but this committee and this Congress is left with no other alternative when, in the midst of an investigation of this magnitude, we are stonewalled at every turn by those who played a central role in the planning and execution of the January 6th attack.
Committee favorably report to the House the committee's report on a resolution recommending that the House of Representatives find Mark Randall Meadows in contempt of Congress.
Okay, the other big story, and it's kind of two stories in one, but they are intimately related. The economy. Is the economy good? Is the economy bad? Everything about the economy is good except for inflation, gas prices, which have been leveling off over the past few weeks. But now there's stories, will it be going back up again? And everybody blames inflation on the president. It doesn't matter if it's not your fault. Inflation is very rarely the president's fault. But Nixon got blamed for it. Carter got blamed for it. Everybody gets blamed for it. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that it's all the way around the world, supply chain, whatever. We've got inflation now. It doesn't matter that we've got the best employment since 1970 or whatever, and the things are and that we've had growth since then. Interesting enough, Goldman Sachs had really good growth projections for 2022, but have had to revise them because it looks like Build Back Better isn't happening, which is really ironic, but that's a whole other story. We have this economy. Is it healthy or isn't it? We don't know. And nobody seems to agree on that. Nobody seems to have a firm grasp on it. We do know that people are not happy with Biden. It kind of started with a lot of chaos in Afghanistan, although everybody seems to be happy that we're not there. But some things happened that weren't really good. Americans were killed. They've been killed consistently over the past 20 years, but it happened, and in a semi-chaotic way. So we've got this going on. Biden promised to stop the coronavirus, but people won't vax, and people won't mask, apparently, in a lot of places. So it's still out of control. So all the same people who are representing, constituents who won't vax are pointing at Biden saying, well, you said you were going to take care of it. And it's not happening. I mean, there's science. People have said that if like 10 to 20% more people had vaccinated last spring, we wouldn't have been out of this by now. I heard that on NPR this morning. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's, that's somebody with more information than I have and more knowledge than I have saying that, but we are still in it. We've got a brand new variant. It's not as deadly as it is, but we're breaking new records for infections and hospitalizations now. And the people who are dying the most are the people or getting the sickest and going to the hospital are the people who refuse to vaccinate, but they don't believe it. People are told that. So we have this situation. Is the economy healthy? Is it not? Are we ever going to see an end to this pandemic? Dave?
Yeah, so this is what a tangled mess we weave, right? Again, there's two elements to this, and I'll address them, I suspect, in the same order you did. So with respect to the economy, similar to what I said about understanding January 6th and the players and their perspectives, where you stand depends a lot on where you sit. So if you look, there's tons of data out there. The big question, obviously, like you said, is about inflation. What do we do about inflation and why is it, how is it, and is the president responsible? So if you look at the actual like GDP quarter over quarter, the profitability, corporate profitability, quarter over quarter, there was a dip when people weren't spending money. But once people started spending money again, after people starting vaccinated, record corporate profits ensued. And the last couple of quarters have been the most solid imaginable, just incredibly profitable.
Yep.
So these companies are making a ton of money right now. And the number one reason why you would not make money is either, you're not getting the sales or you're spending too much. Your costs, your input costs are too high. So the sales are there. We see the sales. There's people who are spending money.
Christmas sales, I think, set some type of record in some places.
So it's not the economy.
So if people are complaining about it, but you're not complaining about it in the with your pocketbook, you're still spending the money.
So these corporations, basically, not that this isn't a corporate bashing moment, it's just sort of an economic reality. They're using the psychology of the increased input costs, the scarcity of labor from people sort of withholding labor in exchange for better terms, which aren't really forthcoming. Yes, wages are up, but for the most part, I don't think labor is actually getting very many concessions across the board here. It's been a contentious battle that it appears corporations are doing a really good job of keeping their labor costs down in spite of their input costs going up. And of course, with the now we're going to introduce the COVID element to this, of course, that there is a real supply chain issue. There was a real backlog and inability for people to get the goods and stuff that they needed and goods and services that they needed. So the demand was there. But what all this sort of leads to, and forensics could you know, we'll know, we'll be able to figure this out in the future looking backwards, but it just appears that basically companies are taking advantage of the opportunities to increase prices, and that's how you increase profitability while you're doing more sales, while your input costs are going up. It just means you're just raising prices more than your input costs are going up. So that's where corporate profitability is coming, the increased growth of corporate profitability. The other thing is that from the COVID side, just in terms of optimism, so the perception of how the economy is doing, I believe that there's a political, not that I believe, I think the evidence shows that there's a political incentive to paint the administration as incompetent or unsuccessful at what they're trying to accomplish. And so it becomes sort of a mantra. It becomes sort of the business community news is saying, is Biden going to mess up and spend a lot of money and ruin things? But that, fiscal policy is not, that's not where you're causing inflation. It's monetary policy. And the monetary policy commitment was to not have the economy stall, not have us in a recession or a depression or a collapse. And so they've been extremely accommodating with near 0% interest rates and with just, billions, many, many tens of billions of dollars, ultimately trillions of dollars that are getting added to the economy. So there's not been any effort on the monetary side by the Federal Reserve. And I know this gets a little technical, but the right. inflation is on purpose. All this money is getting added to the system on purpose. So it's this really strange dance. Now the question is, where is that money going? And if you look at the wealth, the amount of money that people are getting, in people's pockets, that important element of this, where's the money going? All of the gains, like nearly all of the gains for as far back as we can go. But let's not look too far back. Let's just look back during the last year, because this is a year-end summary. If you look, the amount of money that's going to even the group that is like the top 2% down to 10%, they're doing a little bit okay. Everybody below that is not getting anything. So the bottom 90% is getting nothing. The bottom 50% getting nothing. In terms of the massive amounts of money that's getting added into the system, it's getting added into the system at such a high level that it's going to the people that are involved in the financial alchemy, the people that are involved in these much higher, these are billionaires, basically the top 1%, top 1/10 of 1%. The data is all out there. The idea is that it's just not, the priorities are not geared towards making people feel good. Actually, that's the truth. They're geared towards just making people only feel good, not making people actually benefit too much. Our country has done things very differently than other countries throughout, both economically and in response to the pandemic.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's happening that way. But wages are up. So, they are up, but they're not keeping up with inflation. We have gas prices having gone up. Supposedly Omicron is going to drive this down. Supposedly the Fed's going to up rates, up interest rates shortly. I don't know, what kind of effect that's going to have on what you're talking about. I don't know if that's going to pull money out of the economy. I'm sure they'll find a way to have it affect the bottom 90% more than the top 10%. But that is what's going to happen. It'll probably slow down the housing market, of course, and the rest. But but Omicron is slowing down the demand for fuel. Now, fuel companies right now are saying, well, it's going to be going back up again. That might be wishful thinking on their part. I think they're really looking for a bullish take, but there are now pauses on airlines right now because of Omicron. There, 3,000 flights have been canceled over the past few weeks. That's a big, usage of fuel. So, and gasoline is at the bottom of a lot of what fuels in terms of output, in terms of inflation. That's what, it's necessary. It's what moves stuff around. And that's in the price too. So the question is, are people willing to pay? Everybody says, well, meat is so expensive, we'll stop buying it, right? Are people going to stop buying it and buy alternatives to that? And so far that hasn't happened. Maybe if there is a decline in income, for instance, we're about to hit a point where the child tax credit is about to stop. that's going to be less money in the economy, less consumer money in the economy anyway. That means they're going to be buying less things. So is that going to have an impact on inflation? I don't know. Is it going to have an impact on GDP? I don't know. So, you know, but what is going to be the impact, of course? Well, it's, you know, it's Biden's approval rating has actually creeped up a little bit, not a whole lot, but up to the mid 40s in most polls, not Rasmussen or Trafalgar. They're always, you know, ridiculously low. But with a couple of others, probably because of some of the other things that have happened. You know, he had his Christmas special and a bunch of dumb things like that. But the first Christmas special in 6 years or whatever, right? But it's but at any rate, the political impact of it is going to be, is if the prices keep going up, it's going to be hard for Democrats to retake it, because inflation is always the killer, more than unemployment, more than anything else. Inflation is the killer for presidents, not necessarily Congress people, but presidents.
Yeah, I don't envy the White House in any, you know, way at all, because there's no one on their side, really. Sure. The business community has an interest in stifling the investments in green energy, investments in creating new entitlements, you know, all sorts of things that you would think are better for the people writ large. But more importantly, we came from a position of very low numbers the economy was slowed immensely. And I'll wrap this up real quickly. The year over year changes statistically are huge. So everything looks bad when you go from a horrible situation to a tolerable situation. So the numbers are just not lining up in their favor. Granted, we are witnessing it. It's not just numbers. We are witnessing it, but it's going to be a really steep, tough hill to climb for the midterms.
Okay. Well, that takes us to our next topic. All right. We are going to discuss the midterms. So, of course, it is historically, we have been discussing this historically. It's bad for the president, the party that is in the executive power, the first midterm election. But it's kind of a lazy mantra of political analysts along the way. I think it's kind of lazy. People are saying pretty much like it's a fait accompli. The Democrats are going to lose at least one, if not both, both branches of Congress. And it may very well happen. But, you know, I'm seeing changes in the analysis. However, finally, Nate Silver has backed off of this thing about the gerrymandering and about how about how the redistricting is going to give it to the Republicans. He has admitted that they aren't gaining much because it's already to the hilt gerrymandered much. Okay, Ohio, they've got it, but we're going to talk more about it next week, because yes, the Republicans got some good news in Ohio and Arizona, but the Democrats have got good news in Michigan, and it looks like they're going to have good news in New York and a few other places. So it's we'll talk about that again next week. New Mexico, for instance, they're going to pick up a place, and New Jersey, they're going to pick up two, if not three, places in New Jersey. So we'll talk about that. But he says the Democrats will not lose the House because of gerrymandering. They will lose it because they don't get enough votes. Now, that may be true, and that is historically true, and there are things that are not working out in favor of the Democrats. I don't want to try to analyze the House because only about two-thirds of the maps are even in. We don't know who's running for what. A lot of people who are incumbents are, like, there are a couple of there are House seats where incumbents are forced to run against each other. Some might move into others. Others are retiring. They're talking about how many Democrats are retiring. There are also a bunch of Republicans retiring. We don't know what's going to happen with that. So we'll talk about more about that as it goes along. But there are Senate seats that are at play, and 10 of them are key. And everybody's talking about, well, this is how the Republicans are going to take advantage of vulnerable Senate seats. I don't know that the Democrats are any more vulnerable than the Republicans this time around. And I don't know that this historical thing about presidents really plays into the Senate as much, because senators tends to have more to do with who the senator is than who the president is, in historically speaking. And we've got some very interesting races to discuss, and seats that were vulnerable aren't as vulnerable anymore.
I just wanted to frame this for folks.
Sure.
That, you know, each year, each cycle, every 2 years, 34 of the 100 seats are right. eligible, are contested. So that's the total number of seats that potentially could change. But in reality, the vast majority of them are uncompetitive. Yeah. And then this is a 50-50, you know, balanced Senate right now. So each one is important.
Tonight I stand before you, tested by adversity, made sensitive by hardship, a fighter by principle, and the most optimistic man in America.
I didn't make it in life because of my athletic prowess. I didn't make it because I'm a genius. I made it because I worked hard.
There are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know. It is the latter category that tend to be the difficult ones.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad, "Where's the beef?"
Yeah.
And the client asks you a question. How do you guys get comfortable? It's a question. So, what was your answer?
Mr. Chairman,
did you tell him?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to understand.
No, I think you understand that. I don't think you want...
All right, so expanding on this, and because the Senate is so important, because if the Democrats are going to get anything done, they not only have to hold on to the Senate, but they really need to get 53 majority, which basically means a 51 majority, because they're not going to get anything done with Manchin or Sinema. And they might be able to drag them along if they have it. But I want to take a little bit of time. We discussed these some of these states. I want to take a little bit of time to talk about what I think is going to happen in each of these states, because the Senate has been crucial. It has stalled Biden's agenda and the Democratic agenda and everything. And in fact, it's going to have a negative impact on the economy, because basically, in my opinion, the Manchin is owned and Sinema is owned, and he just absolutely killed them. Now, they might come up with some piecemeal thing, and we might get a few bones thrown out. But basically, the question is, are the Democrats going to be aggressive and try to pick up some seats, not just hold on and pick up some seats? I actually think that they have some opportunities here if they play their cards right. As we talked about in Pennsylvania, Pat Toomey is retiring. And Pennsylvania is a state in which the Democrats have a really good chance of winning. It's becoming more blue every year. And they've got Representative Conderlam, Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, other people running. Any one of them has a pretty good chance of defeating it. Parnell, who had been Trump's endorsed candidate, had to drop out because, again, he was deemed to be a domestic abuser. The primary candidate right now is Dr. Oz, who doesn't even really live there, who's basically carpetbagging to go there. Nobody knows who the other candidates are, really. Democrats have a really good shot there. And I, you know, at this point, I would predict that unless there's a major change or it's just so bad for the Democrats because of inflation, again, I'm not buying it, that they pick up Pennsylvania. Dave.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. I think that Lieutenant Governor Fetterman is the lead over Conderlam on the Democratic side. Primary, and this is, you know, people are saying this is their best chance, Democrats' best chance to pick up a seat, in part because the people that they're running against are just not, there's not a strong opposition there. So, for lack of a better way of framing this, I think that this is it's the best opportunity for Democrats to pick it up, because it's not competitive, and Trump doesn't seem to be, he's not endorsing a candidate that has a successful window, a path to victory there.
No, that blew up in his face. You know, and again, that's going to hurt Trump's endorsement elsewhere. Georgia, I mean, we talked a little bit about that. Warnock, again, he might have a hard time against Walker. I don't know. Will Walker be able to hold it together? We don't know. Walker apparently has a lot of issues, but we never know. He might be able to keep it together. Everybody tends to underestimate people and the rest, but we don't know. He is being backed by Trump and McConnell. They have their hopes on him. But again, we've got Stacey Abrams. She is absolutely the star of the Democrats nationally, and she is going to mobilize voters in Georgia. I think the Republicans may have even made a mistake with these kind of neo-Jim Crow laws, because everybody's going to be watching it closely. I think the Republicans even dare try to overturn county elections by the legislature, even though they passed it. They'll be held to pay, and they're going to use this as an impetus. You're going to see, you know, the new civil rights movement. You've got two black candidates that are you know, going to be singing old civil rights song. This is going to be huge. It's going to be symbolic. I think that Stacey Abrams will probably win the governorship, and she will basically carry Warnock into a win over them. And I think the Republicans are going to tear each other apart. You got five candidates. You've got Kemp and four crazy candidates. And Trump just, again, messing things up for the Republicans.
I'm with you. I mean, I played football when I was younger. I love Herschel Walker as an athlete, but the guy's not—he's not a senator. And so I think Trump's instincts here are wrong, as far as my judgment. And it's not, you know, him going toe to toe with the former pastor of the Ebenezer Baptist Church is just not going to be compelling to voters. I don't believe.
So Mark Kelly, also, who was elected, he of course is the astronaut and the husband of, you know, the who was shot a few years ago, very popular. He has to run again this time around, and they see him as vulnerable because it's Arizona. Gabby Gifford, sorry, very popular. They were hoping that State Attorney General Mark Brnovich would be able to run against him, but Trump has basically taunted Brnovich for not doing more to basically keep Biden from winning the state, not coming up for votes for him, right? So Trump voters may not turn out for this guy, but he's probably going to win the Republican nomination. Without that, they would probably have a hard time defeating Mark Kelly anyway, and if Trump is lukewarm on him or not supporting him, I don't see him beating Mark Kelly in 2022. I'm not even sure why this is really on the list, other than the fact that Arizona. Well, I guess the analysis is that Latinos across the country are not as blue as they have been in the past, and Democrats in Arizona in particular haven't been really working to shore up their support within the Latino community. Maybe not, but I think they like Mark Kelly. I don't see that as a serious potential loss. I could be wrong.
No, I agree with you here. I do agree. Senator Mark Kelly outperformed Biden in the last election, so that means he's got more crossover appeal. He's doing well by the states for all measures. And he's not Kyrsten Sinema. So he's actually the more likable of the two there, in terms of from a Democratic perspective. I, like you said, Trump is got his finger on the scale here, and he's pushing out people that have a chance. And instead, it's, you know, for all we know, there's going to be like a venture capitalist Blake Masters or somebody, I don't know what Trump's going to do there, but it's, if you're in a Stop the Steal video, chances are he'll support you. So Kelly against, if it's Masters, I don't see it as being competitive.
And even if Trump shuts up now, Democratic Party operative trolls are still going to play that up to try to suppress the Trump supporting vote. You know, and Trump supporters, if Trump isn't out there really pumping or being on the ballot, they don't turn out. They didn't turn out in 2018. Right. That's why the Democrats did so well in 2018. One of the reasons. So,
and just to be clear, sorry to interrupt you, but this is the cyber ninja state. Like, this is the state. Yeah. I suspect the voters of Arizona are pretty fed up with this whole thing already. At least, you know, the marginal voter out there.
I agree. So I don't see the Republicans taking that. Then we come to Wisconsin. I think this is about close to vulnerable as Pennsylvania. Ron Johnson just went all in, you know, like he was from Indiana or something, you know, forgetting that he's in a state that went to Biden that has become more blue as Milwaukee has renewed, you know, its industry, started to bring in some tech industry, started to bring in more people, Madison as well. It's not the blue collar kind of conservative, culturally conservative area it used to be. And Ron Johnson is just all in. He's like one of the Trumpiest senator there is, pretty much, almost, other than Hawley and a couple of other people.
And DeSantis.
Barnes. Yeah, right. Yeah. DeSantis is just a sycophant. He's not, you know, that he's not, I don't think he really believes it. Johnson probably believes it. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what Johnson is thinking. And he's been caught on tape at actually admitting certain things. But and Wisconsin Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes has already got high profile endorsements. Clyburn, Warren, anyway, and he's very good. I think that this is, he's already raising money. I think Johnson is in trouble.
Yeah, like you said, Lieutenant Governor Barnes has support from pretty heavy hitters within the party, and the progressives who want a more progressive candidate, they'll probably end up stepping in line as faithful, you know, backers of whenever the primary outcome is, which will probably be for the lieutenant governor. So that's this is one of those cases where it's going to be sort of Trump battle on display, like the same saga.
All right, Nevada, Catherine Masto is going to be running against Adam Laxalt, son of Paul Laxalt, and has picked up support from Trump and McConnell. Doesn't look like there's going to be a primary challenge. They're saying that he has a pretty good chance of beating Masto. The only thing is they're going kind of on polls, and Republicans underperform polls in Nevada. So I would definitely not count her out, but that one seems a bit closer and a bit of a better possibility for Republicans. But, you know, we'll see. And if there are headwinds against the Democrats, I can see that one. But, you know, I wouldn't count her out.
Yeah, I think your analysis there is pretty much right on that. Nevada is going to be very competitive, the truth is that it's Trump is going to I think interfere with the Republicans' chances of success there. So it's a massively rural state with a high population concentration in the Vegas area, which is much more blue. And I suspect that it'll be an organizational challenge that ultimately I think Democrats prevail there.
All right. I think we've talked about, we've gone as far as we can. I mean, we talked about Ohio and New Hampshire in detail. Ohio may or may not flip. New Hampshire, I think, is not going to flip. I don't think Florida will flip, much as I'd like to see it. Missouri probably won't flip, but it's dangerous. We've talked about North Carolina, but at any rate, a lot to discuss. We will discuss these races more in the future. We didn't get through all 10. That's just too hard. But we will talk about them more in the future as these races develop. It's going to be very interesting to watch. Again, my overall prediction, I think the Democrats will not only hold on, but pick up one or two seats. All right, Dave. Well, this is going to be our last little segment. Do you have any profound thoughts about 2021 national politics?
I think we experienced a roller coaster in part because of COVID, of course, but also because of that, you know, Democrats controlling the White House and the House of Representatives with the apparent advantage in the Senate, but yet they weren't able to really accomplish very much this year. So this roller coaster, you know, besides some of the other issues that were less, you know, less national in nature, you know, the biggest challenge, what the story of the year is Manchin and you know, Sinema, basically,
yes,
and their obstruction. And, you know, I'm not here to defame or disparage them and their motivations and their incentives, but I think that they did a disservice to the country, to their constituents, and to their reputations. And I think that, you know, we're starting off 2022, right, in this position where now it looks like there's going to be, you know, breaking up the Build Back Better into constituent components, forcing votes on the issues, and who wins when that happens is the people who didn't want change, didn't want a greening of the economy, didn't want an expansion of the social safety net, didn't want an expansion of, you know, Medicare to cover more enhanced benefits for seniors, and that's not what most people want. These are very popular things. So in theory, by breaking it up, we're going to maybe in 2022 cobble together some of the dysfunction. This is the year of dysfunction, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think the Democrats also once again failed to sell that. They, you know, according to polls, people like every individual component of Build Back Better, but don't like Build Back Better because they don't know what's in it. I mean, that is a real failure on the part of the Democrats to sell it. And so it allowed Manchin and Sinema to be able to do this without, you know, having to worry about political consequences, although I think they may face them, especially Sinema. But I agree. I think a lot of people also expected Biden to be the new Roosevelt. I think he's more of a Truman. You know, I think he's in there just trying to patch things up together. I think Harris has to really think about learning the lessons of Henry Wallace, you know, needs to really think in terms of what her future is. Anyway,
what are those lessons? What do you mean there?
Henry Wallace was the progressive that was supposed to be the heir, and all of a sudden found himself out, you know, and replaced. I just think that she really needs to think in terms of what her future is and what role she's playing and where she's going. I'll expand on that as it goes along, but I don't know that she is really playing the role that she wants to play or wanted to play. And well, I don't have time to go into it right now, but I don't think she's doing herself any favors right now, and we'll have to talk about that. But I think that's where it's at. Not going well for the Democrats, but they could turn it around. You know, there's a lot that can happen. I think the Republicans are celebrating a little bit too soon, and we'll see how things are going. Until next week, stay informed, stay engaged, and have a happy new year.